join your host,
Blog Talk Radio,
Solomon and Gail Hunter, as we create a brave space for conversations about racism, personal transformation, and accountability. Conversations provide a means to dive deeply into your thoughts, ideas, and beliefs, and examine what emerges in your words, actions, and behaviors. The show is a journey towards anti-racism by cultivating change within yourself first and then out into the world. Learn to engage in racial dialogue using four tools: courage, conversation, relationships, and accountability. Discover how truth, reconciliation, and healing can emerge from honest and deliberate conversations. Manifest social change right now on Reflection Point Podcast. We're here again to talk tonight about our year in review. Really, we've already had more than a year's worth of shows, and we have all learned so much, we've shared so much, and it's pretty exciting to think about how far we've come. I was just looking over some of my typewritten notes from earlier on, and boy, we have come a distance, haven't we, Gail?
We really have. It's amazing. Yeah. Hi, my name is Gail Hunter, and welcome to this, and Happy New Year. But we have come a long ways. When looking back over everything that we've covered, it's amazing, right?
Right. I'm sorry, I didn't introduce myself. I'm Mavis Bauman. I'm used to Anita doing that. She must be having some technical problems. Yes, and Happy New Year. Happy New Year. So I think what we're going to be doing tonight, and Anita does this so well, she is going to direct us in talking about what parts of our work together have been most impactful, what kind of transformational moments we've had over the last year, and some special parts about being Black globally. So, Anita, can I toss it back to you?
Yes. I apologize for my technical difficulties that I'm having, and I thank you, Mavis, for jumping in, because I don't know if that's going to happen again, to be quite frank.
Well,
So it sounds like you did our intro and all of that and talked about the fact that this is a little bit different. We've done a recap in the past, and in the past we kind of went back and looked at specific episodes, but for this one we want to make it a little bit more personal. And really talk about what this year has been like for each one of us as individuals, and what has been the most impactful piece or part of us doing this, doing the podcast. So why don't we just start that conversation? We talked earlier today, we were talking about some of those things. So Mavis, what is one thing that was really impactful or powerful or really meaningful for you that maybe something you learned or experienced that was new for you?
There's almost too many to list, but I think to start off, I need to say that I had no idea of my role in our racialized society. And that has been so enlightening. Every piece that we've worked on from every part of society, whether it's determinants of health, or certain industries like farming, I am seeing what really pulling back a veil of our racialized society. And it's been fascinating. I had no idea that so many people were really living in a different world from mine. I had no idea. And what I've heard quite a few times lately is I didn't have to pay attention. I really didn't have to pay attention as a white person to what was happening. And now I'm paying full-on attention, and I find it fascinating, exciting, and motivating to act against racism in our world.
Excellent, excellent. So what about you, Gail?
And there, I agree with Mavis. There's so many different things that I have learned over the last year. And I thought I knew an awful lot, right, from studying Black studies in 1970 to, or whenever it was when I was in college, to everything else that I've experienced in my lifetime, but I have to say that I was really astounded when we started doing the historical literacy as far as the content of what really was going on after the Civil War was, quote, won, and how the federal government really did not really step in and do anything for the southern states that were still finding different ways, the black codes and so forth, to continue slavery, just a different form of it. And then also the redlining through the 1930s and so forth, and how that was the federal government behind all that, that made it impossible for anyone that was black to be able to get a mortgage, to be able to buy a house, to create that continual longevity of attaining more wealth. They made it absolutely impossible. And then on and on, there's so many other things I can add to that. But that was probably the biggest conscious awareness that I had that I was not, I thought I was clear on, and I was not clear on it at all. Mm-hmm. And so I am grateful for the information and the knowledge and the wisdom that comes from that. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. So one of the things that really hit home for me, not necessarily in a personal kind of way, but in this way that kind of broadened my scope of understanding how pervasive racism actually is, and that is when we had the two gentlemen, well, actually we had three people. We had the two gentlemen from the Navy, and then we also had a woman that was a military spouse. And so what was interesting for me is, like, I know a lot of the history, and I know, you know, the black GIs coming back from wars, and, you know, they were in, say, Europe fighting for freedom and in the name of freedom and liberty and all of that. And then they came back here, and this is, you know, and racism just basically hit them right in the face. Mm-hmm. But so I knew those things historically. But this was the first time I ever really sat down and had a conversation with two retired military, naval officers, one black, one white, and they were able to sit down and really talk about how different the experiences were between the two of them. So these were two individuals who, you know, they're retired naval officers. They didn't serve together while they were in the Navy. The black gentleman, his name is Reuben Keith Green, and he wrote a book. And when he wrote that book, the other gentleman by the name of Dr. John Cordell read that book. And when he read that book, the two of them kind of came together with this understanding that John's experience in the same Navy was extremely different from Reuben's experience in the Navy. And one of the ways that John described it is that he saw his naval career as sort of a marathon, or, you know, I'm just running a relay race, so to speak. Whereas once he read Keith's book, what he began to see was that his experience was more like an obstacle course. And so if you could think of, you know, a person who is running a race, you know, just a short race versus somebody who is on that same kind of course, but it's an obstacle course. And so that really kind of spoke volumes for me, because this was coming from a white man who served in the military and was able to acknowledge that his experience was very different from what Reuben was explaining. So that really just kind of hit home for me again, because it broadened my scope of knowledge on that, because now I'm listening to somebody's lived experience.
And their experience with each other is so unique, so encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
They were completely honest and locking arms in this process. And I just love seeing that, how supportive they were of each other.
And they're empathic with each other. They're very, the compassion was there and the empathy was there, that they really heard each other. And that was really pretty remarkable.
Great, great. And so there were others, like, for example, when we had the conversation with Rebecca from Switzerland.
Right.
That was a very eye-opening conversation as well, primarily because if you didn't know she was from Switzerland and you just read her stories, you could easily assume that she was American.
Mm-hmm.
And so that whole idea of looking at a lot of our topics through the lens of being Black globally really, really kind of hit home for me mm-hmm. when we had the conversation with her. And in particular, if you remember how she shared that she didn't know she was Black because she was mm-hmm. raised in
Sierra Leone.
Yes, Sierra Leone.
Mm-hmm.
She was raised in Sierra Leone, like her whole life, her family mm-hmm. and all of that. And then at the age of 9 is when they moved to Switzerland. And so you're going from this Black nation into this white nation, and it was quite an eye-opener for her as a little girl, a 9-year-old kid who's now being told and defined by before. So it was really interesting, that experience as well.
Yeah, that for me was a transformational moment. Sometimes it's the simplest things that really jar your thinking. When she said, "I didn't know I was Black until I was 9, that was one of those brain-breaking things. Like, how could she not know? And it's because of this construct
right.
that we have built, the construct of race.
Mm-hmm.
And I will never forget that. I will never forget that, how we have established these separations from each other that are purely invented.
Right. And so she experienced her first 9 years without any of that racist vibe and bullying. And so she got there to Switzerland. And then it started, which is sad. I mean, it's just so sad that she had to then encounter that and experience that. And, you know, it's just another example of white supremacy and racism now exists globally.
Yeah, that is exactly, because it's a global phenomenon. Let's think back to just 2 weeks ago when we talked to Pongiseli Machali, a mm-hmm. South African, she's a friend of, well, now she's a friend of all three of us,
mm-hmm.
But she is a South African farmer, and she's been associated with farming since like the age of 7 and all of that. She works in corporate philanthropy as her job, but she's also a farmer. And so just looking at the plight of South African farmers versus the plight of Black farmers, it's exactly the same plight. It's fighting over land being literally taken from people, right? Rules and regulations being set up, laws and legislation being set up to control where people can live, where they can work, where they can grow. How is that in South Africa under apartheid any different from Jim Crow, redlining, segregation, all of that? So to Gail's point, it's exactly the same story.
Right. A way to exclude, separate, take the wealth from
steal
the property, and that's exactly what
yeah. that's all of what it is.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And that's not that different than when the Pilgrims of America came to the United States. They stole the land from the Native Americans in the same way, mm-hmm. right?
But then you also, when you know that and you see that, it lets you know how mm-hmm. powerful the land is. That land is power,
money.
Right? It's power, mm-hmm. and those who control the land mm-hmm. control the power.
Well, and there's a similarity even after they change it. They try to give back land to the African population that they literally removed from the land that they had before. But they never equipped them with education or with tools or equipment. And they couldn't compete with the white farmers who are doing commercialized farming. And yeah. so it was a setup for them to fail. The government set that up that way. I mean, it's not that different than what was happening here in America.
Exactly. And that's a good point that you're bringing up, the subsistence farming versus commercial farming, right? So while there are so many wealthy individuals in South Africa specifically, Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you think about the United States and commercial farming in the United States, but the problem with commercial farming is that it's about making profit. It's not really about feeding people.
Right.
Which is the reason why we have commercial farming in the United States, but we have people who are starving.
Right.
There's commercial farming in South Africa, but there are people who are starving.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, like, how do you rationalize
right.
that? You can, because of your mindset. You have a certain mindset where, you know, you're looking at things through the lens of capitalism. You're looking at things through the lens of white supremacy and, you know, all of those types of things. But when you pull that veil back, you can see how it poisons us,
mm-hmm.
everybody.
It actually poisons everybody. You're right, Mavis.
Yeah.
It poisons all of us.
Yeah.
Even people that can't see it, it's still poisoning them.
Exactly.
Can't see it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so then... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Since we were on South Africa a little bit, I was just going to add the idea that apartheid in South Africa is the same expression of Jim Crow here in the United States. But, you know, when apartheid was, like, in the early 90s, I was one of the Americans who thought, this is horrible. How can they do this? Not noticing that there's no one black in my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that, and I lived in, you know, Omaha. It was still very segregated.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, I think in a lot of ways there's not a specific intention there. It's just this society that we're raised in and how we're programmed to not grab something as our responsibility. It just is, and so what can I do about it? But to see now what I should have noticed then, it's very humbling.
Great. Yeah. So looking at that same type of experience, for me in the 90s, what I saw was hypocrisy. Like, how can you be mad at the South Africans because they have a system of apartheid when we have these systems right here in the United States?
Right.
And so that was what I saw. These people, white folks, you know, raising, like, no, you know, anti-apartheid movement and everything like that. Anti-apartheid should be no different than what we're doing here in terms of anti-racism.
Mm-hmm. So it's not like hypocrisy, right?
But, right. Mm-hmm. So for me, that was what mm-hmm. I saw. And that's not to say that I didn't want apartheid to go away.
Right.
Yes, but I also want the things that impact my life in the United States that are in the same category to go away as well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
so
exactly.
there's a lot of fighting and a lot of, you know, sanctions and all kinds of things like that. We don't sanction ourselves when it comes to the atrocities mm-hmm. here in the United States.
Right.
We just don't do that.
We don't. There's a lot we don't do here.
Yeah. So let's kind of take that point and move mm-hmm. on a little bit to talking about the topic of racial literacy.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that's kind of associated with racial literacy is really just having a fundamental skill and being able to really look at the existence of racism. So in order for you to look at the existence of racism, you first have to acknowledge that racism is, in fact, a real thing, right? And then examining the effects of racism, institutionalized systems, and...
Oh, dear. We lost her a little bit again. So we have to be able to recognize the reality of what has been, as far as the distributions, as far as the historical information that is out there, to really truly understand it. Because without that truth, we're just going to continue the same behavioral patterns, the same belief systems, whether you're conscious of them or not. They're
right.
there.
Exactly.
The generational programming is there.
Yeah.
Right?
Do you think it'd be okay, Gail, if I just went ahead and read this
yeah.
quote that Anita
yeah,
has for us? With respect to racial literacy, there's a concept developed by sociologist Franz Windows Twine, UC Santa Barbara Department of Sociology. She describes racial literacy as a form of racial socialization. I'm just reading this quote, Anita. An anti-racist training that parents of African descent children practiced in their efforts to defend their children against racism. End quote. In her research done in the United Kingdom with mixed race families. Did you want to comment on that first part of the quote, or should I continue?
Okay.
You're muted now, girl.
Yeah, I definitely want to respond to that. And I apologize. I don't know what's going on. I'm having some technical thing here. But when I read that, it just really occurred to me that that's what we're doing, is we're passing along racial literacy to our children. And we're doing that as a defense mechanism. We're doing that because we need to tell, like, I have my 2-year-old grandson, Cairo, but I also have a 14-year-old grandson, Zane. And eventually we're going to be sitting down and having these conversations, particularly with Zane, because he's like, what, 2 years away from wanting to have a driver's license. And I can tell you in my own being, the idea of him having a driver's license as a 16, 17-year-old is almost horrifying to me. And the things that we will have to teach them, teach him, that we teach on a regular basis, the talk, like you've heard us refer to this, the talk. There's that point where you have to sit down and you have to explain to your children, this is how the world operates. And so that is racial literacy, because we're teaching them, this is how this system works, and this is how you need to learn how to protect yourself to the greatest extent that you can in order to be able to survive in this country. Another thing that kind of popped into my mind, and then I'm going to stop and let someone else talk, but the other thing that popped into my mind is when I think about the Green Book, right? Mm-hmm. That book that we used to produce when we were traveling, you have this Green Book, so you know this is a sundown town. Don't go there. These people over here, they're good. They don't mind black folks. That's another example of this racial literacy in terms of how Dr. Twine defined it. So these are things that we have to do. We have to be literate in racial practices, laws, and all of that in order for us to even be able to get up and walk out the door on a daily basis.
And be safe. And be safe.
So, Anita, this does not refer to any racial socialization of white children, then. White families are not talking.
No.
Racial.
I don't have that.
Right.
And we don't have that conversation with my kids. You know, I had other conversations, but
not
that conversation.
Yeah, so different conversations, right? That's kind of interesting to think about what those, how those two conversations would be so radically different. Okay. I think the things that I heard were be afraid, be very afraid of black people. You know, that was all that I heard. It wasn't something that went on and on.
How do you then position your hands and I mean everything that white teenagers and on and adults don't even think about?
Yeah,
if it's
we'll
be able to see it or something. Right,
that different. I never had to watch my body language or anything. Right,
you didn't have to fear for your life.
No, not in my white bread neighborhood.
I read an article the other day, too, and it was about the whole thing was flight, fight, or freeze.
Mm-hmm.
We don't even get to have that. Think about it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get to have that. Like when I think, for example, Antoine Rose was a, you remember Antoine Rose, Gail, who was murdered, a murdered teen. He ran because he was afraid.
Right.
And he got shot down. He wasn't running because he was doing anything
wrong.
He was running because he was afraid. So we don't even get to be, like, fully in something that is naturally occurring for people, fight, flight, or freeze.
Right, the brain, how it operates.
Yes. So we're denied that as well.
And I can tell you that when you activate that part of that the brain, the amygdala, it's really hard to have to overdrive that, and that's what you're describing has to be done. Yeah.
Right, that's exactly what it is.
You can't have that in the freeze mode, right? It can't even just be still. because they have to be able to communicate in a way that is not going to cause any possible risk of harm. You know?
Exactly. So we have about 3 minutes until we're going to go to break. So Gail, or either one of you, Mavis or Gail, if you could read that second block just in case I get knocked out again.
Okay.
Go ahead, Gail.
Okay. The second one is a skill and practice by which individuals can probe the existence of racism and examine the effects of race and institutionalized systems on their experiences and representation in the United States society.
Again, that's racial literacy.
If you can continue and read that next block.
Becoming racially literate requires that. As educators, humans, we can, this is what we all can do, engage with the emotional content of any conversation that has a focus on race. We can welcome personal narratives and the lived experiences of all who are involved in race conversations. We can talk confidently about our own racial identities, feel confident in creating and engaging in healthy and reciprocal cross-racial relationships, and challenge racism at the individual, group, and systemic level.
So when you think about what you just read, that's racism, anti-racism activation.
Right.
It's being able to do those things. So you can see the connection between what we describe as anti-racism activation and racial literacy.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. We all can participate.
If you think about what are our four things,
right.
Courage, conversation, relationship, accountability.
Accountability.
It's embedded in those bullet points there.
Right. And that is when we can each choose that, we begin to change our belief systems, and that's what's going to change this from the inside out, right? Our internal belief systems must change individually for it to change collectively and globally.
Absolutely.
That happens back from within each of us.
Absolutely. And so when I think about all of these things, we have about another minute, so let me just make this point before we go. When I think about what we've been doing, as I lay it up against this content here and this information, it makes me feel really gratified with what it is we're doing, the direction that we're going in. Even though, if you think back in the beginning, I was just kind of making everything up as I went along. But as I went along and things got more solid, and I got more well-versed in certain topics, like when we did social determinants of health and all of those types of things, the picture began to emerge that what Inflection Point Podcast is really all about is increasing and improving historical and racial literacy.
That's right. Exactly. Yes.
Good point. So I think at this point, we'll take a break.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Inflection Point Podcast on Transformation Talk Radio, and we are discussing the need for historical and racial literacy and how that has informed our podcast here. And we think you're just going to really fall into this with us because it really changes how you look at our society, our racialized society. So, Anita, you want to take it from here?
Yeah. So speaking of historical literacy, I'm going to share with you a little bit about when I got my master's degree, right? So I have a master's degree in educational leadership because I was really interested in how do you design programs and educational things that actually work for people, right? And one of the things that I did in my studies is whenever I was looking at differences like educational disparities, instead of focusing on the African-American community, because I already knew a lot about that, I made a choice to focus on the Native American community. And so that opened up my eyes quite a bit in understanding what are those atrocities that have been perpetrated against that population of people, right? But one of the other things that really stood out for me is that was the time when I got exposed to Paulo Freire. If you've read his book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, that book really just opened up my mind to such an incredible extent. And when I was putting some of this stuff together and looking at the concept of historical literacy and what good is literacy, this is something that he said that really ties into some things that we've been saying lately as well. Looking at the past must only be a means of understanding more clearly what and who you are, so you can build the future more wisely. Isn't that what we talk about when we say the past informs the present in order for us to empower a better future? It's the same kind of concept.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I think of the role of historical literacy and what historical literacy means. It means having that understanding of history. How does it work? How does it connect to me? How does something that happened in 1619 connect to Anita Russell and connect to our current situation? Your thoughts?
Well, if we don't allow ourselves to learn history, we won't learn from it. We will continue to repeat the same patterns. And that's been proven over and over again in many different cultures and countries and so forth. And so it's crucial for us to change. In fact, even in my own personal life, if I don't look at my life from birth on and really look at what was going on, what choices have I made, what is it that helped me and what hurt me, what nurtured me, I'm never going to be able to work in the present to change those patterns and my beliefs about myself in a way that can actually allow the future to transpire in a very different way, right? And so you can take it at looking at it at the individual level, at a community level, at a state level, at a nation level, and globally, that we all have responsibility to ourselves and to our own history to understand and to know it and to learn it. And that includes our racial and racist history. You know, very important. What's amazing is that there's so many, there's a movement that wants to ban any information around systemic racism, right, in school districts. And it's already been that when I went through school, so much was already eliminated, right, and omitted, that to omit and eliminate, continue to do that. We are never going to learn from one generation to the next until we're willing to step into that place of truth and really learn what the truth really has been. And then we can begin to look at and see within ourselves and to make those changes. It's crucial.
And to acknowledge. And that's why I look at the work that we do and other organizations. I'll talk as an example, or so many other organizations, some of the people that are part of the summit that we have coming up. The whole entire thing of we need to take a stand to create this movement, this grassroots kind of movement, so that we can continually just push forward, just keep pushing the envelope, just keep pushing the envelope. And I think one of the things that's really powerful now is this whole idea of dialoguing, of having conversations. Robert Livingston's book, The Harvard University Professor, that book is amazing. And that book has been a guide for me in terms of how do we sit down and have these conversations, because they need to be had individually, person to person, like this.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. I don't know what I would have done without the two of you. I never thought about my identity. I never thought that much about the historical factors of racism. I thought it in terms of today and how that impacts people, but in a very superficial way. So getting into the history has really helped me uncover how those wounds are carried forward and how we really need to understand how those wounds impact the identity of others. That to me has been so powerful, you know, especially kind of prepares me for a spot response to, well, slavery was so long ago, can't we just move on? And now I get the connection. I get the huge a cast of characters in a way that have perpetrated you know, this suffering on people of color, you know, white people basically. And, you know, without really acknowledging that, that my identity is white and how that affected the information that came to me, I don't know. I am thrilled to have access to this now, because a while back when someone said, what would you do? I had nothing. I had no idea what to do. Now I can see. Now I can see and I can act. Yeah, and you guys have been so, so patient with me. Break my brain, right?
But that's the thing. We all have to be willing to step into the conversation to have our brains broken. Because if our brains are not broken, and I say that metaphorically, but if our brains are not broken, we can't really move beyond our own thinking. Because that's really what breaking your brain is. It's collapsing this way of thinking and replacing it with another way of thinking, right? And that's what these conversations are all about. And it's white folks whose brains really need to be broken. And some of these things I mentioned here with the historical literacy and the racial literacy, white folks need that.
Exactly. The information of historical and racial literacy to build up that new thinking. It's not like you can just replace our old thinking. It's very stubborn. It doesn't want to go away. And, you know, we want to let our feelings get hurt and push people away and not learn. But, no, going to the history, going into the lived experience of people, it's critical to understanding.
Absolutely. So, Gail, you were about to say something?
I was saying that people of color have always had that knowing, that experience, because they lived the experience. It's white people that must begin to take a look in that mirror within themselves and be honest with themselves, because we won't change anything unless it's based on truth. And there are blatant truths that have been, you know, thrown under the rug and not wanted to be looked at and seen, that occurred in the beginning and that are still underlying everything and white supremacy today. And so we have to be willing to look at that and all the truth within ourselves and within us as a white race, right? And what we have chosen over the centuries.
Exactly. If I could just comment about the work I'm doing in Rwanda. My organization is called Seed a Better Life. And a lot of what we talk about here causes me to refer back to that work because of the distinction between an ethnic groups or racial groups is just deadly. It can go to such a degree that we would think we would never participate in, but it has happened on every continent on this planet. And so, you know, Rwanda has taught me a lot in that sense. We just have to, very simply, honor each other as human beings.
Mm-hmm. Which is the Mbutu philosophy.
Yes.
Yes. I am because you are.
Yeah.
And it's the whole entire thing that says, I can't even be human without you.
Mm-hmm.
Because every single person that is born into this world, I look at Cairo, he's learning what it is to be human by observing us and interacting with us. So how would he possibly be able to do that if he didn't have us? You know what I mean? And so that's what I love about that principle, because we can't be human by ourselves.
Exactly.
We're about connection,
right? We're about relationship and connecting, and we learn through that. We thrive from that, right? From the time we're born on.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
Go ahead, Mavis. I'm sorry.
These thoughts are coming. Listening to the lived experiences of you know, our Black participants in the podcast, and certainly you, Anita, for years. It's just different than anything you can read or as these fine ladies tried to teach me early on, to absorb intellectually. It's the lived experiences of people that you're with, staring into their eyes and really hearing and feeling their pain and opening your heart to understand it. That's how to make progress, I think.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. We all have the capacity to do that, and we all can step into that place of opening to do that.
Yeah. And that's one of the beautiful things about the three of us.
Mm-hmm.
I always look at the work that we are doing and how far we've come mm-hmm. just in our own ability to have conversations,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And I can honestly say that even in the times when we were having some tough conversations, I never had the experience that either one of you was kind of dismissing anything that I said. It was usually the opposite, like, can you tell me more? What does that mean? I need to know what that means. And even like what you made is some of the times when I told you, don't intellectualize it. Just let it go in. Just let it go in.
It'll be a long time.
But look at your progress.
Yeah, I can feel
it. Look at your progress.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. A year ago, would you have been able to talk the way that you're talking right now?
Oh no. And you know, my goal is to be able to talk like this with other white people so that they hear and feel. And I really want to get there. I really want to gain those skills because it's our responsibility to attack this head on.
Exactly.
You know.
As I always tell you, it's not our responsibility to change people. People have to be willing to change.
Good point. No one can change another. Only self can change self.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. People have to make that choice. I mean, it's just like being saved. When you decide you want to accept Christ, you can't. Your mom can't accept Christ for you. You have to get to that point where that's something that you are moved to do, and this is not that different from that. It's like you just have to wake up one day and make a choice that says, I really want to get out from under the thumb of racism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because it's oppressing
that as a white
black
person.
People. It's oppressing everybody. It's affecting everyone, even when they don't see it or know it.
Yeah. Another analogy that's really helped me is that racism is not the shark, it is the water we all swim in.
Yes.
So if you think about swimming in water, certainly if you're a fish, you're not thinking about the water. And I was completely guilty of that, you know, for so long. I was just swimming in the water of this racialized society. And things like that helped me break away from what probably wants to be defensiveness in me, you know?
Yeah.
I think I'm such a nice person, but that ain't no good. You know, it's just, it's not enough. Yeah, so that's been really helpful, those analogies.
Mm-hmm.
And your coin analogy.
I'm glad you mentioned the part about being defensive because that's where a lot of white people go when you hear people say, well, what about? Like we were talking earlier and you were saying that you were sharing something about the plight of black farmers with a white gentleman
mm-hmm.
and his response was, what about white farmers? It's like, okay, the white farmers own what, like 85 to 90% of the land? Like, well, what about the white farmers? It's just kind of funny sometimes when people respond that way and it just lets you know that they're neither their historical or their racial literacy is very sharp.
Right. And he probably suffered, you know, in a number of ways as a small farmer, which is where I was trying to take the conversation. But the reaction was really, really strong, and it surprised me. It shouldn't, but it did.
He also, whatever his suffering was as a farmer, it wasn't because he was a white guy. It wasn't because of his skin color.
Yeah,
no, exactly.
I think that's the part that people have a lot of understanding, like I understand that you suffered in your life. I get that. But whatever the suffering that you had, it wasn't because you were a white person.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, exactly. Boy, that's a hard one to get, I think.
It is.
And talking to people,
crucial piece.
I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. We don't ever want to hear that expression again. But, you know, that kind of suffering is so completely different from the color of my skin I have to think about when I walk out my door.
Right. Yeah. You're just being crazy by the color of your skin. I mean, it's just,
yeah.
It's almost.
Yeah. It's the whole concept of it.
Yes.
You know,
and yet it's so real. It's been so real.
Well, and who was it that said if racism is insanity? Was it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't remember who that. Yeah, that quote
yeah,
that comes from.
It is.
I don't remember where it came from.
Yeah,
because it's just made up stuff.
Well, it's based on a lie that was based on trying to cover up the reality of what was going on with.
Right. Can you imagine, like, let's take it, this big thing and bring it down to something really, really small. Can you imagine if you were just a person going along in your life and you woke up one day and realized that everything that you had been taught about your life, your family, was a lie?
Right.
You see, because you think about how tied up your identity is in your that social system is that you're living in. It's what we were talking about earlier with the relationships. We're all human, so we live in these social little communities and all of that. So what happens if you wake up one day and find out that everything about the people that were in your community is built on a lie?
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough thing to wrap your mind around.
Right.
And that's exactly what's happening right now with all of these conversations about racism, because white people are waking up and, well, I don't know if they're waking up or they're being bombarded, if you will,
right.
More and more information. I can say in this time period, I don't remember any other time period was this much information was being produced around the topic of racism.
In every form of media, conversations, movies,
book, everything. Well, because of the media, because in the 60s, 70s, when there was so much protesting going on, that people knew, but they didn't live with it day to day. It wasn't on their face with the media, as the media is now, that they were seeing and hearing it as it was happening.
Yeah, and plus there's less control now. When we were talking the other day about the idea, when you think about the murder of George Floyd, people were videotaping. They all had phones. We didn't have that in the 60s and the 70s. So we were, like one of the, Dr. King, I think it was Dr. King, one of his strategies was to, when they were being attacked by the dogs and everything, their strategy was to get the media to come there and cover what was happening there. Now you don't have to do that. You don't have to call, some news wire agency, blah, 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 blah. You just call your neighbors, call your friends, and all of that, because we have so much at our fingertips now, so much information, in spite of the misinformation and the false conspiracies and all that junk that's out there. We have a valuable tool in our hands now that we didn't have in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, the whole murder of George Floyd, I mean, that was the first time that ever happened, but it was the first time that the massive public saw it live happening, right?
Right, exactly.
And the look on Chauvin's face, got to me. I know young black men have been killed for centuries, but the look on his face, not even like he was squishing a bug.
No.
There was no emotion in that face.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you get there? Yeah, it just, it's
sickening.
Sickening.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so us being able to see and witness all of that, it was like a big difference in when you think about the 60s and the 70s and even going into the 80s, it was just different, you know. And I often think to myself, because now you can pick up your phone and you get the news and it'll be, you know, like I'm in Brooklyn and, you know, there was a robbery over there and there was a robbery down the, not literally down the street from where I am, but I think also a difference is the volume. So I don't, can I say that crime is actually more from a statistical perspective? Is it increased more, or is it just that we're exposed to it more? Like you could have your phone on the local news in Sparta and every single crime that happens in Sparta shows up. But does that mean there's more crime in 2023 or 2022 than there was in 1997?
Yeah, it's captured now.
It's captured. Yes, right. It's captured. Mm-hmm. And everybody has access to it. Everybody has access to it.
Right.
And so that's why, you know, when I hear people arguing about the, you know, the crime rate and, you know, things are more violent. Well, are we really more violent or are we more aware
of violence? Maybe the statistics would hold out and saying that there actually is an increase. But my guess is, just as you're saying, it's that we're just more consciously aware.
Yeah. I don't know if this is correct. But it seems to me that then these videos become part of our racial literacy.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
It means that.
Right. Anybody who wrote that story would have a spin.
Right.
You know, so, yeah, we want the truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So we are literally almost out of time. We have about another 2-3 minutes or so. So before we go, I want to call out the first annual Anti-Racism Activation Summit that is commencing next week. It starts January the 9th through the 13th. So it's 15 speakers in 5 days. And basically, it's a group of speakers that come together. They're experts in various fields, but the one thing that we all have in common is that we share a story of how the murder of George Floyd impacted us not just personally, but in terms of the work that we decided to do. So what was that work that grew out of, you know, from an anti-racism activation perspective? So I'd like everybody who's listening to go over to theplacetosoar.com, and as soon as you get there, there's information there on the summit. As I said, it starts the 9th. You must be registered to attend, and registration actually closes on Friday night. So get over there, get registered, theplacetosoar.com. Magus Gale, what do you want to call out real quick?
I'm excited about this summit. I really want to encourage people because the people who are speaking, aside from the three of us, in addition to, are so extraordinary. Different walks of life, different approaches. This is the kind of creative input I think all of us need. When you hear what people are actually doing, it might spark something in you. So, again, go to Anita's organization website, theplacetosoar.com.
Don't convince yourself that you can't be there for that time because it's recorded, and so you have access to
exactly
the same sort of a different time period.
It's very flexible, 3 lectures a day or speeches a day, and you can watch them at your leisure, and it's free. Who can say
it's free?
People are down to like zero time at this point.
Okay.
For those of you who are listening, I just want to thank you for joining us at Inflection Point Podcast here on Transformation Talk Radio. And as a reminder, we are here every first and third Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific Time and 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and I hope I see your name on the registration list for the first annual Anti-Racism Activation Summit of 2023.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Inflection Point Podcast, where our mantra is cultivating change from the inside out.
The journey towards anti-racism and social change doesn't stop here. Truth, reconciliation, and healing come from ongoing, open, honest, and deliberate conversations. Continue to dive in and deconstruct your thoughts, ideas, and beliefs as we band together to manifest social change. Tune in to Inflection Point Podcast every first and third Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, here on TransformationTalkRadio.com for more conversations about how we can cultivate change from the inside out.
Expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. Contests are the responsibility of the host of this program and not KKNW. This is Alternative Talk 1150 AM, KKNW Seattle, and KNUC 98.9 HD3 Seattle.
And good Monday morning to you. Benny Mathers here for a look at your Alternative Talk AM 1150 traffic update for around the town. I-5 northbound just south of the 405 interchange on miles 153. A recent collision partially blocking the right center lane. State Patrol has arrived on the scene, and they are taking care of that collision. Stay tuned. Coming up next, after the news and weather, it's Tech It Out Radio with your host, Mark Saltzman.
NBC News Radio, I'm Michael Kastner. The Kansas City Chiefs and Philadelphia Eagles are set to face off in a rematch next season. This after the Chiefs came back from 10 points down to beat the Eagles 38-35 on Super Bowl Sunday in Arizona. The exact date and time of the Eagles-Chiefs game will be determined when the full 2023 schedule is released. An Orlando couple is dead following the massive earthquake in Turkey. Alex and Veronica Ilgin were visiting family when the quake struck last week. Their friend told Spectrum News 13 Alex's mom and brother were also killed. The death toll from the devastating earthquakes is now more than 35,000. The Chinese spy balloon, which recently floated across the nation, may have been listening in on American conversations. Senator John Cornyn says this should be a wake-up call.
The Chinese Communist Party are not only stealing secrets, but threatening our national security.
The Texas Republican blasted the Biden administration for not shooting the first balloon down earlier like he did the others. He asserted the balloon can take more accurate photographs than a satellite. Questions remain after the U.S. military shot down three flying objects over the weekend after the balloon from China was taken out of the sky earlier this month. Officials haven't clarified what the latest three objects might be, but New Yorkers say the truth is being withheld.
I believe they know, and I wish they'd tell us. All the fingers point to the Chinese. So gotta be trying to steal information from us.
They probably do surveillance all the time, and we just don't catch it. Or we're not publicizing it.
Others believe aliens are finally trying to contact Earth after years of space exploration. Governor Gretchen Whitmer is defending TikTok as a communication tool.
We have it on one device that has no access to anything else, because so many people get their information that way.
Appearing on CNN's State of the Union, the Michigan Democrat explained that whether politicians like it or not, TikTok is a tool for disseminating important information. Michael Kastner, NBC News Radio. The European Union's economy is set to exceed expectations and avoid a recession in 2023. In Brussels, Alex Cattier says the bloc had previously predicted it would go through a technical recession brought on by high energy prices.
Growth is projected to hit 0.9% in 2023. That's up from the 0.6% predicted in the autumn. After hitting a record high of 10.6% in October last year, it's set to decline to 6.4% in 2023 and 2.5% in 2024. EU Economy Commissioner Paolo Gentiloni warned that Europe still faced strong headwinds and uncertainty because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, meaning many in Europe will still be feeling the pinch.
The California Senate race is heating up and getting bigger. Bay Area Congresswoman Barbara Lee is about to announce her candidacy for U.S. Senate. The 12-term House incumbent has a response for rivals arguing that she's part of the status quo in Washington. She says experience matters.
I'm a black woman, a woman of color, who had unique experiences that the Senate is lacking.
Lee has represented the East Bay for decades. The top competitor in the race, Irvine Democratic Representative Katie Porter, launching her campaign in a video announcement by stating that it's time for new leadership in the U.S. Senate. With no black women currently represented in the Senate, the 76-year-old Congresswoman hopes to change that. She's expected to announce her candidacy for U.S. Senate later this month. One of the stars of Real Housewives of Salt Lake City is fighting the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints over a trademark request. Heather Gay has asked for a trademark on the term Bad Mormon, which is the title of a book she's written about her life. She wants to use the phrase on merchandise, but the church has filed a challenge to her application for the trademark. They say her use of the phrase could cause harm to the reputation of the church and its trademarks, which include Mormon, Book of Mormon, and Mormon.org. Michael Kastner, NBC News Radio.
The Money Hour with your host, Tina Mitchell, every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. right here on KKNW AM 1150. Join the show to experience expert advice and knowledge on today's events in our local economy that can affect your money. That's every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. with a repeat show on Sundays at 8 a.m. For more information about The Money Hour radio show and their guests, visit themoneyhour.com. That's themoneyhour.com.
Hello, this is Reverend Walden, asking to tune in every Monday on 1150 KKNW at 2 o'clock for Mother's Justice Show. What we do is keep the grassroots voice alive, not only in Seattle, but around the country. We interview lots of people around the country. We've been on the air for 7 years, and we've been working for police reform for 30 years. Tune in every Monday for Mother's Justice Show on 1150 KKNW. Check out our website at www.mothersforpoliceaccountability.org.
And let's go ahead and take a look now for Alternative Talk weather. Outlook for Monday, well, we'll see mostly showers on and off throughout the day today. We might throw in a thunderstorm or two after 1. For that, a wet Monday. High temperatures around 44, 45 degrees. Tonight, temperatures dropping down to just above freezing, which might bring rain and snow mixture. Low temperatures down to about 34. For Tuesday, decreasing clouds, so partly cloudy skies with a few sun breaks. Highs of around 43. Mostly clear skies Tuesday night. Lows down to freezing, down to about 32. For Wednesday, mostly sunny skies and highs of around 45.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers.
Feel overwhelmed by the ever-changing world of technology? Tech It Out can help make some sense of it all. Breaking down geek speak into street speak, technology columnist, author, and TV personality Mark Saltzman covers consumer technology each week for every listener. Mark tackles the latest news, reviews, and how-tos to help you understand what's hot, what's not, and why.
Hey everyone, welcome to a brand new episode of Tech It Out. This is episode 282. If you're keeping track, hope you're all having a great day so far. And thank you for making Tech It Out a small part of it. Hey, we have many great guests lined up for you today. So I'm going to dispense with the small talk off the top of the show so we can get right to it. Two of our interviews today are loosely tied to Valentine's Day, which is coming up, of course. The first interview in a moment isn't the best news, though. It's about the rise in romance scams, those predatory fraudsters online who are trying to get women to fall in love with them and then steal their money. Visa will join us and tell us what to watch out for. And be sure to share this info with your family and friends who may be looking for love in all the wrong places. And later on in the show, it's a bit more of a positive spin on Valentine's Day. It's a dating app that's getting popular called Vinyl.ly that pairs music lovers up, and not just based on similar musical tastes. We'll learn about that in about 30 minutes from now. And sandwiched between these two interviews is a special guest from General Motors about a new virtual showroom to learn about electric vehicles with a real person to talk with over video. It's super cool. Wait till you hear about it. It's called EV Live. All of this and more on an all-new Tech It Out, powered by Asus for those in search of incredible. I'll tell you more about Asus shortly, but let's officially kick off the show with our first interview. With Valentine's Day around the corner, many plan to celebrate their loved ones. But hey, this Hallmark holiday isn't always about roses and chocolates. It could be about deception and fraud. From catfishing to fake dating sites, so-called romance scams are on the rise. to share what's going on and how to protect yourself and perhaps your vulnerable loved ones, we're joined by Dustin White, Chief Risk Data Officer at Visa. Welcome to the show, Dustin. Good to chat with you.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Before we talk about romance scams, as they're collectively referred to, I believe, please tell us a bit about Visa's, and I'll call it significant, investment in fighting fraud over the past few years.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you again. And security is core to Visa in many, many ways. And everything that we do really focuses on that trust factor and the 360-degree protection of our consumers, businesses, and the entire ecosystem that operates on our network to move money around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
Significance is a good word. Over the last 5 years, the significance of the investment is upwards of $10 billion to make sure that we have the right tools, tech, and capabilities out there to stop fraudsters in their tracks. And that includes combating fraud proactively with cutting-edge cybersecurity, advanced intelligence or AI, and some of the advanced data analytics that our teams around the globe produce. So despite the rise in fraud and the increasing sophistication of scammer tactics that I'm sure we're going to talk more about, fraud on our network remains at a historic low at a time where more people are using digital payments in more and more ways. And it's something we're really proud of. And like I started with, it's kind of core to the DNA of who we are.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, I've had a chance and privilege to chat with your colleague, Michael Jabara, VP and Head of Global Fraud Services at Visa, about the billions of dollars, billion with a B, Visa has made over the years in fighting fraud. And it sounds like it's working, which is great. At the same time, I heard romance scams may be on the rise. What are the risks out there today, Dustin?
It is on the rise. So whether you refer to it as catfishing or look at fake dating sites, scams that play on our heartstrings are on the rise. There's been a lot of publication, I think, about this over the last 6 to 12 months, but the FTC and others have indicated that these types of scams are up significantly, almost 80%, and the losses that consumers have reported are to the tune of $500 million in 2021 alone, and I'm sure that number is consistent for 2022. It just hasn't been released yet. So the trend isn't slowing down, right? And I think as consumers continue to adopt new forms of digital payments, folks that look to prey on those folks, bad actors, will continue to attempt to take advantage of them. And the ways they do that are becoming more targeted and sophisticated. There's a whole litany of ways, but eventually what it results in is the scammer will casually convince the target to start to divulge either financial information or invest in things. It could be cryptocurrency or other types of fake websites that point their victims to these landing pages, and they continue to put money into it and might even be under the belief that they're making money when, in fact, they're just draining their own finances into a scammer's bank account.
I hear about these stories often, whether it's, you know, the catfishing stories where they bait somebody into believing they're falling in love with them and then they hit them up for money, or they scam them digitally, like, I don't know, asking them for Google Play gift cards. They often prey on those who are, you know, not so tech savvy. They could be elderly. It really does boil my blood. What do you attribute this increase in romance scams? Do you think it's sort of coming out of the pandemic, we were a bit more isolated, or just overall we're spending more time online as a society?
You know, it's probably both, Mark. I do think that our lives, the digital influence and time we spend in our lives accelerated rapidly during the pandemic. That's no surprise to anybody, I don't think. And I think because so much of what we do in the physical world, we now do in the digital world, the notion of cultivating relationships sort of falls into that bucket, right? When you work and study and shop and connect with people you care about, ultimately building relationships, things that happen in those chance interactions in the physical world, they happen digitally. And with more people spending time online and money online, bad actors see that as a target-rich environment. And I think the other piece of it, too, like you have to think, during the pandemic, folks that probably weren't as engaged in digital commerce and interactions sort of had to necessarily shift there. So not only do you have more folks there, you've also got folks with like a less sophisticated experience threshold in that environment. And I think, unfortunately, it comes down to how well can you pick up on some of this stuff in communication. Those of us who live our lives in email, which unfortunately I do, but more often than I'd like, you can sort of pick up on it right away. You see it in a note. You see certain kinds of language patterns, certain types of graphical things. And you like to think, hey, you know, I'm an expert. I know how to spot this stuff. But we've actually done some studies on this. And then one of those was a study called Fraudulese, the Language of Fraud. And in that study, we found that 73%, that's a big number, of consumers who think they're confident about recognizing scams often miss some of the red flags. And when you compound that with a whole bunch of folks that are in the environment kind of in a, for the first time or are newly engaged in digital commerce, digital interactions, you know, you can only imagine that number goes a lot higher. And on the back end of that, so you got the experience level, but the rise in digital payments has now transformed money movement, which makes it easier and faster and more seamless to move money around. And there's a whole bunch of different channels and methods and ways to do that. And that just has created a bit of a perfect storm for this particular scam.
And speaking of which, what's also particularly scary about the numbers you provided, romance scams being up nearly 80% year over year, is that that's only among those who reported the crime to authorities. It's likely a much bigger number than that, I would assume, because people were too embarrassed to report them falling victim to the authorities. So it's probably even a worse problem than we think. We are chatting with Dustin White. He's Chief Risk Data Officer at Visa, a company that has invested billions over the years in fighting fraud. Today, we're chatting about the different flavors of romance scams and how to protect yourself from these predatory and malicious types out there over the internet. So with that in mind then, Dustin, what can we do to fight back other than spread awareness, you know, with our loved ones? How do we spot these fraudsters before becoming a victim?
Well, I think experience certainly plays a role, right? The more that folks interact and engage online, the notion of disingenuous versus authentic communication comes into play. I think there's a few things. You can be aware of what you post online, right? Anything you put out there, if fraudsters are picking up pieces about you as a person, they'll go as far as they can into various sites and places to learn what they can.
You mean like social media? Like saying, hey, you know, sucks being single around this time of year, like that kind of thing?
Yeah, you got it exactly right.
Okay.
Right? I mean, someone could on LinkedIn see that I work for Visa, on Facebook, maybe they can find out that, you know, I've got kids and things like that. And they start to piece this persona together to make their attack more personal.
So calculated.
You know, in addition to being aware of your online footprint, you know, it's important that you also sort of put yourself on the offensive and do your due diligence. When someone new is trying to connect with you that you've not met in the physical world, see what you can learn about them. Too perfect is really often not a reality, and you can pick up on some of that pretty quickly. And I think, you know, just noticing the types of behavior, there are reasons for people to reach out to you that you don't know. Like, for example, if you're selling something on Facebook Marketplace, that happens all the time. But it's what they ask for in return, right? If the things that they ask for in return are personal details or financial information, inappropriate photos, anything that you could give them that could be weaponized against you, I mean, that's a big one. And probably the biggest red flag, don't send money to someone if you've only communicated with them online. You know, I would jokingly add, like, wait till you're in a long-term relationship or married, your spouse or partner will find ways to take all of your money anyway. you don't need to send it to someone you haven't met.
That's a good one.
Yeah, awareness is a big part of it, as you alluded to, right? The educational components are really important, especially for those who might be in the elderly population that are engaging in digital commerce in ways they haven't historically. The scams aren't just limited to romance scams, right? There's other things that target seniors in particular, including things like healthcare insurance fraud, counterfeit prescription drugs, reverse mortgage scams even. So, you know, stressing to your friends, family, people you care about, no matter what age, that they should be thoughtful about that, lock your devices, no red flags, share with care, all these things that people can do when they are releasing or engaging online, right? The things that you put down into the internet and digital platforms, they're there for good. And the thing, you know, you should be very thoughtful about the types of details you share, especially early on in a relationship.
All great advice, Dustin. And finally, the best website to learn more about Visa's efforts in fighting back against fraud?
Visa.com.
All right, Visa.com. I'll even add Visa.com/security has a lot of blog posts and articles about Visa's efforts. Thanks so much for your time, Dustin. Great to chat with you. Very informative.
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me, Mark.
Coming up on Tech It Out, we're going to chat with General Motors about this really cool virtual showroom called EV Live. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
Listen to Tech It Out whenever you want. Find the Tech It Out podcast at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Prescription products require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information. Subscription required.
Hey guys, did you know there's a generic form of Viagra that works just the same but is 90% cheaper? And you can get it online? Just go to forhims.com/joy. At Hims, you'll get a free medical consultation, discreet shipping if prescribed, a 100% online process, and trusted generic alternatives to the biggest brands at 90% off. That's right. Get generic for Viagra, the same active ingredient as brand name Viagra, but 90% cheaper. It's the same medication you get from your doctor, but with zero copay, no expensive appointments, and no awkward face-to-face conversations. To start your free online visit, you need to go to this exclusive address, forhims.com/joy. That's forhims.com/joy for your free online visit. forhims.com/joy.
60 seconds of service.
A million in Mecklenburg. That story next.
Celebrity Salute is a weekly podcast that features great celebrity and newsmaker interviews and their support for our troops and veterans. Everyone from Tom Hanks and Bradley Cooper to Dolly Parton and Bryan Cranston. Check out Celebrity Salute on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
More than 800 veterans and their families were served at a three-day open house held in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina last week, with more than $1 million in benefits likely to pay out as a result. Held for the first time since 2019, the event gave vets from across the region a unique in-person opportunity to ask questions and get answers about their benefits and claims, plus learn about other valuable services. Attending veterans represented at least 11 states, including most of the Southeast, Colorado, Texas, Idaho, and New York. Approximately $345,000 in retroactive benefits were paid out during the 3 days after claims were processed on site.
The word never carries a lot of weight. Never forget, never settle, never surrender. And now Dodge is proud to announce Never Lift, the full-throttle rally cry of stepping on the gas and never letting up. With the 475 horsepower Durango SRT 392 and the muscle car dynamic duo Dodge Charger Challenger, and the introduction of Dodge Power Brokers, your official dealer for legendary direct connection performance parts. For more on the Never Lift mindset, go to Dodge.com. Dodge is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
This message comes to you from our sponsor Subaru and their first SUV of its kind, the all-new, all-electric 2023 Solterra, built to help protect the environment so it can be explored. It's the first electric vehicle to feature the legendary standard capability of symmetrical all-wheel drive to take you to places traditional electric vehicles can't reach. Love is now electric. Learn more at Subaru.com/Solterra.
Are you a psychic, sensitive, or seeker who wants to learn more? Are you a mystic on the path who wants to go further? Tune in to The Mystic School, where your host, author, and spiritual teacher, Sarah Wiseman, will share with you all things mystic and metaphysical. Join us as we dive deep into the divine realms of psychic opening and spiritual awakening, and how you can live as an intuitive soul. Tuesdays at noon on KKNW, or wherever you find podcasts.
I can't believe we have to make this commercial.
It's ridiculous.
You'll think it's ridiculous too. Listen to this.
This commercial is about, well, it's about parents being rude at high school athletic events.
Ridiculous, right?
It gets worse. Studies show more than 75% of new high school officials are quitting because of bad adult behavior.
So now there's a shortage of refs here in Washington, in almost all sports.
No officials means no more games.
Is that what you want for us?
Come on, parents.
It's time to grow up.
Cheer for your team.
Be proud of your children.
But stop being so ridiculous.
And don't make us run another commercial.
Because we will.
This message presented by the Washington Interscholastic Activities Association and the Washington State Secondary Athletic Administrators Association, reminding you to always practice good sportsmanship.
It's time that you are heard, and I don't mean in just a conversation. I mean really heard. Imagine hosting your very own radio program on Alternative Talk 1150. Talk about being heard. Call 425-653-1150 right now to learn how affordable it can be to host your own radio show. Time slots are going fast, so take hold of this chance by dialing 425-653-1150. Alternative Talk, we have an opportunity waiting just for you.
Bringing good vibes to the Puget Sound and the world. Alternative Talk 1150.
Hey, welcome back to Tech It Out, powered by ASUS for those in search of incredible. ASUS creates technology for today and tomorrow's smart life, and that includes its line of award-winning laptops and desktops. accessories like monitors, keyboards, and mice, mobile tech, tablets, smartphones, and much more. For those in search of incredible, visit asus.com/us/radio for more info. That's asus.com/us/radio. We chatted with Visa earlier about romance scams and what to look out for, and to share that info with family and friends who may be looking for love in all the wrong places. But coming up in a few minutes from now, we're going to chat about something a bit more positive, a dating app called Vinyly that connects people over music. That's coming up in a few minutes to continue our Valentine's Day theme. But first, we have a special guest from GM to chat with us about electric vehicles. Listeners of my show know I'm super excited about the intersection of technology and the automotive space. And if you're a company like General Motors, the two are very much intertwined. We're going to learn right now about a brand new initiative called EV Live. It's an electric vehicle education tool. And to tell us all about it, I'm thrilled to have back onto the show Haas Hassani, GM's VP of EV Ecosystem. Welcome back to the show, Haas. Good to chat with you again.
Thanks, Mark. Likewise. Great to be here.
Sure. Now, hey, before we talk about EV Live, why is technology an important pillar to GM, to General Motors?
Well, I mean, technology has been core to our DNA, and innovation as an extension of that has been core to our DNA since our inception. And the last century of innovations in the auto industry, a lot of them trace back to innovations that General Motors first brought to the market, whether it's, you know, going further back to things like crash test dummies, or maybe in more recent memory, OnStar and bringing telematics to vehicles, and what OnStar has been able to enable, certainly in our vehicles, but that has in some way been mimicked across. So it's really important for a company like General Motors. Technology is in the innovation that springs from that. When you are trying to reach as expansive an audience as we are, bringing technologies that are really purposeful but also affordable and accessible and approachable. You know, we've got vehicles from Chevrolet to Cadillac and everything in between. So for us, technology really spans that gamut.
Even Buick. I'm going to be seeing the Buick concept car at an upcoming
Wildcat
automotive show. Yes, Wildcat. Thanks, Haas. That's it. I'll see it in a week and change. All of the brands underneath the GM banner seem to embrace technology in a big way. Chevrolet and Cadillac, of course, do come to mind, as well as GMC and Buick. So look, GM's commitment isn't just about electrification, which is in the news a lot these days, but automation as well. You hinted at Super Cruise. It's a fantastic technology. Before we talk about EV Live, can you just give our listeners a bit of a Super Cruise 101?
Yeah, so Super Cruise, I've had the privilege of driving vehicles with Super Cruise for a couple of years now, since we introduced the technology on the Cadillac CT6 a few years back.
That's my vehicle, by the way. That's what I drive.
Nice. I'm telling you, every time I see one on the road, I like remember fondly my commutes between Toronto and Detroit with a Super Cruise equipped Cadillac. And I have to tell you, it is hands down the best autonomous driving technology. You use the term autonomous somewhat colloquially in that context.
Mm-hmm.
But it really was the first system that allows for fully hands-free driving on highways. You know, you're not tapping the steering wheel every couple minutes or couple seconds and stuff. It's full-on autonomy when you're driving on the highways. Now, of course, you have to be paying attention to the road. We've got a camera sensor and sensors that are checking out your attention on the roadway. But, you know, if you're in the driver's seat, your hands are off the wheel. And it makes such, I mean, obviously there's some certain safety benefits to having that technology, but there are real physiological benefits when you've experienced, particularly in media case, a four-hour drive where, you know, most of that Toronto-Detroit corridor is highway driving, and Super Cruise was active for almost the entirety of that drive. It makes a real difference to you physiologically when you get to your destination.
You feel more refreshed.
Absolutely.
So just again, in plain English, when Super Cruise is enabled on supported vehicles and you're on a highway, freeway, many hundreds of thousands of miles supported in North America, your car is essentially driving for you. Your hands can be off the wheel, but your eyes need to be on the road just in case. And it curves along with the lane. So you stay in your lane, it accelerates or decelerates based on the traffic around you, and it can even change lanes for you, whether you want to signal and change lanes, or depending on the model, you can let Super Cruise determine which lane to change into and when it's the right time. Feels really safe. I've got a video of me on YouTube, and my daughter was recording me, and I'm excited about my next vehicle, the Cadillac Lyriq, which no doubt will have this technology. So thanks for that, Haas. Without further ado, let's now talk EV Live, which is why I wanted to invite you onto the program. At a high level, what is EV Live?
So EV Live is our on-demand virtual EV education platform, and customers or anybody really can go to evlive.gm.com, and what we've done is we've purpose-built a studio to educate people on electric vehicles. We're not giving any sort of, you know, sales pitch. It's not about selling a specific model of EV in that studio. It's about helping people understand what an electric vehicle is, how it can fit in your lifestyle, how is it different than a gasoline-powered vehicle. And we're going to break down, you know, concepts like charging and the battery and cost of ownership, the range, the types of models that are out there on the road today. So it's really about getting people over the hurdle of considering an electric vehicle. But as often happens when you create a platform like this, we're finding other use cases emerging and other types of people calling in to EV Live, which is pretty interesting in and of itself.
You mean non-GM customers?
Well, yeah, we're getting owners of our competitors who have recently purchased an EV. We'll leave them nameless for now, but some of the popular other EVs out there. We're calling our EV specialists because we have real humans. These aren't avatars or bots or anything like that. We've got real EV specialists in this purpose-built studio having video conversations, one-way video conversations, so the caller can see us. We can't see them.
Apologies, Hop. We're just going to put a pin in that for a moment. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, continue chatting about EV Live. We'll be right back.
Want to follow Mark? Google him. Mark with a C and Saltman with a Z.